Captain Alicant by Fitz James O'Brien. One of the habitués of the Hominy House in the village of Hopscotch, New Jersey, was a short, thick-set, nubbly old gentleman who had once followed the sea, and was in consequence called Captain Alicant. He inhabited a snug little cottage in the environs of Hopscotch, and spent a portion of each day in the bar-room of the Hominy House. I have described the Hominy and its landlord ere this in Harper's Monthly. That majestic General Dubley, with the green hair and the painfully imposing manner, that melancholy establishment with an old revolutionary matron in a back room, always making tea, and who might on occasion be caught smoking a clay pipe. There was nothing very prepossessing in either Hopscotch or its hotel to draw me there so often, but the scenery in the neighborhood was fresh and pleasant. Not far from the village, the Passaic, as yet a tiny stream, wandered through wooded valleys and formed large calm pools where the laughing country boys bathed in the hot summer days. The land was broken into green swelling slopes which were crowned by rich crests of wood, where one might hear, high up amidst the trees, the whirr of the wood pigeons' wings as they fled before intrusion. A few stray woodcocks were to be found in the summer, feeding on the succulent marges of the little river, and there was a tradition of rattlesnakes having an abiding place on a certain stony hill not far from the village. So you see, Hopscotch was not without its attractions. I liked the place well enough. It was calm and stolid, and old General Dubley did not talk enough to bore one. But if I was tired of the General's description of the way in which he received Lafayette, or the reminiscences of the revolutionary matron in the back parlor, who was continually recording the fact of her having put a gun into the hand of her youngest son to go to Lexington with, I wandered off among the peach orchards with which the neighborhood abounded, and watched the orioles and the blackbirds, or superintended the drunken revels of large blue bottles as they boozed upon the juice of the fallen and fermenting fruit. Captain Alicant, as I said before, was a regular visitor at the Hominy House. He was a hard, weather-beaten old fellow with such bad sight that he had to be led to the house by a boy and led back home again. But he never would acknowledge that he was blind. He used to sit in the window and gravely comment upon the aspect of the outer landscape which he never saw, and criticize the appearance of neighbors of whose presence he was aware only by their voices. The captain was always accompanied by punch. Not that I mean he carried a supply of the seductive but stimulating beverage of that name continually about with him, but his invariable companion was a Skye terrier similarly christened, a sort of animated muff on legs, a quaint bundle of hair with large, pleading eyes, affectionate heart, and a tendency to get continually into disgrace. Punch, I regret to say, got into more disgrace on my account than on any other. I think I must have been his first love, for the day he met me he formed an attachment for me that was a source of unceasing annoyance to the captain. He, from that moment forward, became a vagabond dog. He would not sleep home of nights, but would trot down at unearthly hours to the hotel, and sit whining and scratching at the door until I got up and let him in, when he would creep guiltily under my bed and sleep happy and contented until morning. The captain was wounded at this display of affection for a stranger, and although he was too polite a man to mention the matter to me, his vows of vengeance on poor Punch for his derelictions were frightful. He had been, when at sea, seized off Tangier, and sold into slavery once himself, and I could gather from hints he let drop that he often meditated inflicting some such punishment on the traitor terrier, discovering some cruel and piratical dog merchant, and consigning the unhappy Punch to all the horrors of servitude and starvation. The ostensible object of Captain Alicant's daily visits to the Hominy House was the purchase of a certain piece of land which the General was very anxious to dispose of, and on the verge of which purpose the captain had hovered for the last 10 years. Every day the general, in a magnificently indifferent manner, brought the matter up, and every day the captain graciously entertained the scheme and indicated a final answer on the morrow. Then followed a scheme for a villa to be built, for Alicant was rich, and old Dubley was in consequence deferential to him. Improvements to be made, drains to be cut, vistas to be opened, shrubs to be planted, all of which visionary schemes were gravely discussed, and the pair parted. One satisfied that the land was as good as sold, and the other that he had bought it. There was one other subject on which the captain invariably entered, always abusing himself for his weakness while he did so, but dwelling upon it in so fond and prolonged a manner that I could see his heart was in it. Captain Alicant had an only son, who, at the age of 19, had committed a grave error, and to avoid facing the ill nature and scandal-mongering of that wretched village, he ran away from home, and had never been heard from since. I had never seen him, but report described him as a tall, rosy-cheeked, lithe-limbed young fellow, full of spirits and good nature, and a general favorite with all the girls of the neighborhood. After he had slipped up, a number of persons were to be found who had always thought there was something bad in his eye. His mouth and its expression were discovered to be indicative of criminality, and what had long passed for a fresh, attractive joyousness of manner was now proven to be the first symptoms of the showy recklessness of bearing which invariably accompanies abandoned criminality. To all appearance, Arthur Alicant had no more deadly enemy than his father. The old gentleman was furious that his honest name, preserved as it had been by the salt of every sea on the globe, should be given as a sport to the world. "The scoundrel," he would say savagely, when talking about it at the Hominy House. "I hope he's dead. As long as he lives, I'm not safe. He'll turn up in some place or other as a thief or a murderer, and then we'll have an Alicant hung. That will be a pretty morsel for the papers, won't it? The son of Captain Alicant, with a full genealogy of the family, and the victim's dying speech in which he alludes to his father. Curse him."
"There was no excuse for him, Captain. None whatever," solemnly exclaims General Dubley, the brute,
who would have burned his mother alive, I verily believe, to serve his own interests.
"If a young man can't see his own interests, why, let him go. That's what I say. Honesty is the best policy, Captain, in the long run, and you remember what I say."
And the general concluded with a puff, as if an abscess of original thought had just then burst in his brain, and he felt all the better for having it off his mind.
"Give me another glass of that applejack, General," continues old Alicant, oblivious of the other's obsequious morality. "And don't put much water in it. I can't think what spell that villain could have thrown over Rose that she thinks so much of him. She always defends him. In my very teeth, sir. She says that his fault was only a piece of youthful folly, that I ought to search for him and bring him back. What do you think of that, Dubley?"
"Miss Rose is a foolish young girl, Captain. She doesn't know what she's after."
"She's not foolish, sir," cries the captain, instantly firing up. "She's one of the cleverest girls, sir, that I ever cast eyes on. There's not her match in the parish, sir. But," he continues, moderating his tone, for he occasionally perceives his inconsistencies, "she's in love with him, General. That's it. There's no accounting for women. But I'd rather see her dead and buried than married to such a scamp as that."
"He mayn't be alive, Captain. You ain't heard from him for 4 years, says the old heartless humbug,
who is so blind as not to know that a father's heart is never dead to hope.
"That's true, Dubley, that's true," answers Alicant, in a queer, throaty kind of voice. "He's dead, mayhap. Well, with all his faults, he was a handsome fellow, wasn't he, Dubley? Damn that dog! Where is he? Punch! Here, Punch! I'll hang him when I catch him. If I don't, may I be blank. Doubly, give me another glass of that applejack, and mind, don't put much water in it.
The captain drinks his toddy in a stormy manner, but I, who am standing close to him, can swear that I see tears falling into the tumbler. The following winter I had occasion to go to Hopscotch on business. It was one of the hardest seasons that we had had for many years. All landmarks were blotted out. Little more could be seen of the smaller farmhouses than their chimneys. Boys and girls rode in their rough sleighs across country, merrily dashing over the buried fences and fields. Apple trees in the orchards were just able to thrust a few bare, struggling top branches over the great white sea in which they were submerged, like a drowning swimmer who in his last agony throws up his hands before he goes down. Snowbirds were flittering along the edges of the barnyards, pursued by boys with inefficient guns, which it required 10 minutes to load, 5 minutes to cock, 1 minute to pull, and half a minute to go off, which, as you may imagine, was all the better for the snowbirds. At his usual hour, of course, I beheld Captain Alicant drive up in his sleigh to the door of the Hominy House, in order, doubtless, to complete the purchase of the land for which he had been in negotiation so long. I should perhaps have said that the captain was driven, because the reins of the sleigh were held by a pair of tiny hands nestled into large fur driving gloves, like birds creeping into moss warmed by the sun. And the hands belonged to a sweet, innocent face with merry blue eyes, in which long black eyelashes gave a dash of sadness. And face and hands and eyes, to say nothing of a little mouth that was absurdly small and beautiful, all belonged to Miss Rose Alicant, the grandniece of the old rover of the seas, who would not buy Doubly's land and who would drink his applejack. I had heard of Rose before. She was a sort of good fairy to the neighborhood. She used to drive about to poor people's homes and always had something in her pony wagon to give them that made them feel better. A piece of beef for Christmas or a turkey that she had raised herself. I don't mean that these things were given as charities. Oh, no. She gave them as delicately as you, reader, would send a specimen pair of capons from your farm to a friend. To be sure, she might have got a greater reputation if she had gone around giving tracts instead of turkeys, but somehow she did not run to tracts. And yet she taught Sunday school assiduously and was the pet of the clergyman. As soon as her grandfather was safely housed under the protecting roof of the gorgeous Doubly, Miss Rose gave a flourish of her whip over the black pony, and off she glided on some one of her good-natured missions, with Punch seated on the cushion, barking recklessly, and entering into the rollicksomeness of sleighing with an almost human enjoyment. The sky all day was dull and lowering. As it wore on, those thick, heavy, determined flakes of snow began to fall that are so eloquent of a coming storm. The wind rose, too, and drove them before it like so many white pigeons blown through the sky in time of equinox. And by the time that Miss Rose again appeared in her sleigh to drive the old captain home, the very moment, too, when he thought that he was just about completing his purchase, the air was thick with snow, and the wind howled and tore around corners and rooted up everything in its way, as if the demoniac swine of the Bible had been again set loose and were galloping about the world. The night came on, and it was awful. The weird noises of limbs cracking from the trees filled the air with terror. The snow was driven here and there and everywhere by the storm, and was so buffeted that it oozed in through the cracks in the window sashes, and once inside, melted and died. It seemed as if there came down the hills of heaven innumerable and gigantic coursers, wild as the horses of Scythia, with a mad rush, and tramping and snorting and shrieks that split the night. I think old Doubly was frightened, for I heard him get out of bed and go down to the barroom, and I feel positive that his mission was to get some applejack to keep his courage up. But down at the old captain's, another scene was acting. I heard all about it a few days after. He and Rose had gone to bed. The storm still howled, and they could not sleep. Their rooms adjoined, and presently the captain heard Rose's voice calling at his bedroom door.
"Well, child," growled out the old Triton, "you're frightened, are you? Oh, go to bed. There's no fear."
"No, Grandpa, I'm not frightened. Only poor Punch is howling outside the hall door, and you have the key, and I want to let him in."
"Let him stay there, hang him, and freeze," swore the captain. "He's always going down to the Hominy House after that New Yorker there, that Massey. Let him stay where he is. I won't let him in."
"Oh, Grandpa, you will. The poor doggie, so affectionate, so fond of you and me. And he was so fond of poor Arthur. Oh, do give me the key, Grandpa."
"What's Arthur got to do with it? You're always talking about that scamp and bringing him in on every occasion. If Arthur himself was there, I wouldn't open the door."
"But, Grandpa, you must." She knew her influence and used it when necessary. "If you don't, I'll...
Here Rose did not exactly see any alternative, but before she could hit upon one, the captain, who always kept the house key under his pillow, threw it towards the door, saying, "There! You always have your way. Let the varmint in. But mind, don't let him come all wet and draggled into my room. If you do, I'll hang him in the morning."
Rose vanished with the key. In less than a minute she was back, breathless, panting, almost convulsed in her eagerness to speak. "Grandpa! Grandpa, for God's sake, get up! There's a man lost in the snow! Oh, do get up!"
"Why, child, you're going crazy. What man? What's it all about?"
"Look, Grandpa, look at this! Punch brought this neck handkerchief in his mouth to the door, and he won't come in, but keeps running backwards and forwards and moaning like anything. And I know there's someone lost in the snow."
"By Jove, it looks like it," cries the captain, now thoroughly aroused. "Rose, call the boy and tell him to get a lantern. I'll go and look myself."
"Oh, don't, Pa. You know your sight isn't good, and..."
"My sight not good? Bosh, it's as good as it ever was. I tell you, I'll go myself, with Tom."
"And me also, dear Grandpa."
In a few minutes, all was ready. Tom, the stable servant, appeared with his lantern, and the captain, when he descended, found Punch at the door in a state of frenzied delight at seeing the preparations for departure. He barked and jumped and ran a little way into the snow, and then returned, looking like a combination of bearskin and ermine, he was so snowy and so shaggy. And when at last the exploration party set out, he sobered down somewhat and ran a few paces ahead, looking back now and again to see that he was followed. It was hard walking that night, I tell you. But fortunately, Punch's field of discovery was not far distant. Not 100 yards from the cottage, the light of the lantern fell on a black object lying in the snow, and Punch barking round it like mad. It was a young man, ragged and pale and quite insensible. Rose, thoughtful as women always are, had brought along some of the captain's choice old Jamaica and poured it down the poor fellow's throat. By this means they managed to revive and stagger him along to the cottage. A fire was lit in the parlor. Plenty of hot bottles and hot toddies and all sorts of hot things were provided by the cook and Rose. And at last the poor frozen wretch opened his eyes and gasped some inarticulate syllables. Rose, in order to hear what he said, stooped down with the candle in her hand and put her ear close to his lips. Then she turned and looked at him for a moment, then gave a wild shriek and fainted. Here was a mess. The poor old captain was bewildered. The cook and Tom ran and came and brought salad oil for smelling salts and generally misconducted themselves. The captain, distracted with two patients, knelt down by Rose and chafed her temples. While doing so, he felt a touch on his shoulder. A tall, gaunt, white-faced young man was standing over him. His voice was feeble and broken, but still the captain heard him say, "Father, let me try and revive her.
I know she will come too if I touch her hand.
Arthur!
It is I, father. Will you? There was no answer to the timid question, but with one long sob of joy, the father clasped the son in his arms, and in that moment all was forgiven. The ensuing summer, I went down again to Hopscotch with a valise containing my nobbiest dress suit. I was to wear it on the occasion of Arthur's wedding with Rose, to which I had a special invitation. The bridegroom, in spite of his many hardships and pilgrimages, and he had suffered to starvation, was looking as joyous as a bobolink, and as to Rose, she was maddeningly bewitching. After the wedding, I created a great sensation by solemnly decorating Punch with a collar made especially for the purpose, and bearing, as an allusion to his intelligence and affection in discovering the poor vagrant in the snow, the inscription, "Il attend toujours." General Dubley was highly indignant at not being asked to the wedding, but I confess I never thought so much of Captain Alicant's sense as on that occasion. The end.